Yeah, so well, here we are, and we've got quite a lively room coming together. I see our founder, David Kelly, our chairman of the board of trustees, Jay LaPere, my favorite regular, Melanie, and Scott. So I'm going to, and of course, Roger, our rock star. Roger, one day I'm going to have to ask you about your profile pic. Is that really you, or should I recognize who it is? But anyway, it looks like we've got a good crowd coming in. So, Rob, tell us, enlightened self-interest, why and why now?
Well, why now is, I think it's a perennial topic, but I also, it's just inspired by some things I've just seen in the fairly recent past. One of the things that inspired this, the thought of doing this topic is I was reviewing a book by Tom Nichols, it's called Our Own Worst Enemies, I think it's called, which is basically trying to say what's gone wrong with society? What do we need to fix? Why are we going off the rails? The usual kind of topic. And the interesting thing is he spends a lot of time talking about our problem is selfishness. There's too much selfishness. And then casually in passing at another point, he says, well, our society, it's obvious our society runs on enlightened self-interest. And then goes on and talks about other things. I think, well, wait a minute, how does he not connect these two things? If our society runs on enlightened self-interest, why doesn't he talk about that anywhere else? Why does he mention it only in passing on something that's supposed to diagnose the ills of our society? You would think if we had a society that runs on the principle of enlightened self-interest, that should be the main topic, the central topic of any attempt to discuss these issues. But you can sort of see how people come from this background where they've been told selfishness is bad. Selfishness is not just evil, it's the essence of evil is selfishness. And so at the same time, enlightened self-interest is in fact how most people live. It is in fact what our society runs on. And most of the people who spend their time denouncing selfishness, they also follow some form of enlightened self-interest. They are not for the most part, they're not living as monks in a cell, having drinking, consuming only the very bare necessities of survival so they can spend all their time serving others. They act on their own self-interest. They have jobs, they have careers they pursue because they enjoy it. They have, they get paid, they have houses, they have spouses, they have all the good things in life that they're enjoying. And yet at the same time, if you ask them, what's really bad, they'll say selfishness is really bad. So it's this weird sort of thing where everybody lives one way, but they refuse to or cannot bring themselves to acknowledge that that's how they live. And for the few times they can bring themselves to acknowledge it, like that in that Tom Nichols book, where he says, oh, well, obviously our society runs on enlightened self-interest, they can't bring themselves to analyze that and to say, well, let's spend a whole book talking about what is enlightened self-interest? What is it that makes it enlightened? What are the principles behind it? They can't bring themselves to take it seriously enough to really analyze it. One of the other things that popped out again about me and to me about this, and this has been a constant of the pandemic. I started again recently. I wrote an article about this a little less than a year ago, which is people saying people who are these are people who are advocates of wearing masks or advocates of getting the vaccine, who will say people who don't do it are selfish. Now, I want to just not bring up the issue of masks and the efficacy of masks or the efficacy of the vaccine. I made the mistake of bringing up the vaccine on Twitter this morning, and I've got the wake up sheeple crowd in my mentions, who say I'm shilling for Big Pharma or something. Anyway, so aside from that, I want to look at the form of the argument, right? So if you were an advocate, if you want people to get vaccinated, if you want them to wear masks, if you want them to do whatever it is, and yet you tell them that not doing that is selfish. What you're saying is, it is in your interest not to do the thing that I want you to do. And I pointed out how, in this article I did last year, I pointed out how self-defeating and undermining this argument is. that you're basically, you're trying to get people to get the vaccine by telling them it's in your self-interest not to take it. And so, but the reason why, and if you actually put the argument to people that way, if you told them this is the argument you're making, they would probably say, no, 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 that's not what I meant. But here's the thing, what's happened is that the idea of selfishness as being evil and as the defining characteristic of evil has so seeped into their consciousness that whenever they want to say something's bad, whenever they think something is bad, that it's immoral, and they want to make it really strong, that I think this, they, the selfishness is the word that pops into their mind. It's selfish. It basically,
Rob, you're bad kind of cutting in and out. That's all that it means. So just make sure your Wi-Fi is up and close by. Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, I know my Wi-Fi is terrible. I'm actually depending on my cell phone reception. But anyway, so my point I was making is that selfish has become this word for, if I want to call something evil, I want to really emphasize it. It's really something super bad. Selfish is the word people leap for without really thinking very much about the actual implications of what it means. Now, this is in contrast to the way things used to be. So it used to be that enlightened self-interest. Now, as objectivists, we're advocates of rational self-interest is the phrase we use. 200 years ago, the phrase that was used was enlightened self-interest, or sometimes called self-interest properly understood. And so I've got a great, one of my favorite quotes from Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America. He's talking about how he says the doctrine of undiluted self-sacrifice is something that, quote, that moralists, quote, no longer venture to suggest for consideration. And he talks about how widespread the idea of self-interest properly understood is in America. So he says, this is a quote here, the doctrine of self-interest properly understood is not new, but it is among the Americans of our time that it has come to be universally accepted. You hear it as much from the poor as from the rich. The Americans enjoy explaining almost every act of their lives on the principle of self-interest properly understood. It gives them pleasure to point out how an enlightened self-love continually leads them to help one another and disposes them freely to give part of their time and wealth for the good of the state. I think that in this they often do themselves less than justice, for sometimes in the United States, as elsewhere, one sees people carried away by the disinterested, spontaneous impulses natural to man. But the American is hardly prepared to admit that they do give way to emotions of this sort. Now you see his standards are coming in there. He thinks self-sacrifice is good. So he's saying, well, the Americans don't give themselves enough credit because they will go out and sacrifice themselves sometimes. And but he's pointing out that among the Americans, it's you know, they don't want to admit they ever do that. They want to explain everything they do can be explained by self-interest properly understood. And this goes back even before Tocqueville. A friend of mine, I never tire of promoting this book because I think it's really helpful. A friend of mine did a really interesting book called Father of Liberty, and it's about a guy named Jonathan Mayhew. He was a New England preacher in the late 18th century. He died just before a few years before the American Revolution, but he influenced a lot of the Boston crowd that would go on to have a leading role, like John Adams and people like that, who had a leading role in the Revolution. And he preached a version of self-interest properly understood. A quote from Jonathan Mayhew from what is, now this is a preacher giving sermons, right? But this had made its way into the religious doctrines of America in the 18th century. And so one of his sermons, he says, we find by experience that we are all capable of being happy or miserable to a great degree. Pain and pleasure, at least, are private and personal things. And even they that arrogate to themselves the right of judging for us do not pretend to feel for us also. Now, if it be of any importance for us to be happy for ourselves, it is of importance to judge for ourselves also. For this is absolutely necessary in order to our finding the path that leads to happiness. And he concludes by saying, virtue is what we are under obligation to practice without the consideration of the being of a God or of an afterlife, barely from its apparent tendency to make mankind happy at present. Now, this isn't a sermon, by the way. He's telling you that you don't even need God to have morality. So this gives you an idea of how this is, you know, a sermon he's preaching in like 1750 or something, or 60, around 1760. So this is a very widespread view, this idea of self-interest properly understood, Mayhew uses the term rational happiness. I mean, you, when you read the stuff about Mayhew, it's interesting because it's almost like he's almost a proto-objectivist in some of the arguments that he makes. It gives you an idea of the direction we might have taken. Now, as to why we didn't take that direction, I came across an interesting article a while back about called Altruism Comes to America. Now, altruism was originally developed as a very, very specific moral theory by a guy named Auguste Comte, a French philosopher in the early 19th century. So about the time that Tocqueville was writing this stuff about the Americans, this guy back in France, this guy Auguste Comte, was coming up with a theory of altruism, and it means otherism. It means the idea that, you know, not just self-sacrifice, but total, complete self-sacrifice. The idea that you shouldn't pursue your own interests at all, and that you should only do things that would benefit, only do things only solely for the benefit of others. And this idea came to America, and it sort of took over, and it reaches a point now where it became synonymous with morality. And it took over, and I've read an interesting article done in the early 20th century by a philosopher looking at tracing the influence of Comte's theories as they come to America. And from what I could tell is that it spread and became universal because it split into two different strains, each one which adopted, which is that on the sort of cultural left, the socialists absorbed altruism into the communists and socialists and collectivist philosophies because it fits perfectly with them. You know, the you will sacrifice for the good of the workers. And then at the same time, the religious establishment absorbed and adopted altruism as a philosophy because it fit with the religious message. You should be like Christ on the cross. You should sacrifice everything for the sake of others. All right. So this idea of self-interest properly understood sort of died out by the end of the 19th century and became replaced. And it reached the point we're at now where people will mention it in passing, but nobody will really give it serious consideration. So I think we need to give it, I think we need to grasp this history that it has, the long history of enlightened self-interest in America, and then give it some serious thought as well. What does that mean? How does it work? And then I've got some things to say as we get into the discussion about how that relates to how it's slightly different from and how it's also similar to the objectivist concept of rational self-interest.
Excellent. So want to remind everybody, we're going to record this. We also have the autoplay on, so you'll be able to go back and give it a listen. And we would love to get your questions, your comments, your disagreements. I know we have at least one social worker in the room. So how does this apply to your profession? How does this apply to your personal life? And so David, you wrote a whole book, Unrugged Individualism, which dealt in part with this.
Yes, thanks, Jag. Thanks, Rob. That's a great historical background. The idea of enlightened self-interest is a term that we've considered, and I spent some time looking it up. The passage from Tocqueville is, of course, you know, really interesting. But I think there's a subtle difference, and it makes a difference, that enlightened self-interest is normally conceived as it says people who and this is actually in from a Wikipedia article, so but it was well done. Enlightened self-interest is a philosophy stating that persons who act to further the interest of others or the groups they belong to ultimately serve their own self-interest, and I think that's aligned with Tocqueville's conception. Mm-hmm. And the article actually goes on to distinguish that from Rand's view of rational self-interest. And the way I interpret it is that the idea of enlightened self-interest plays a little bit into the altruist game of saying, well, yeah, you serve others, but actually that helps yourself, as opposed to the objectivist view, which is you serve yourself and you pursue your own self-interest. And part of that self-interest what I have termed benevolence. It goes beyond benevolence because it goes to civic mindedness and taking responsibility for political activity in service of goal, serving the goal of freedom, which is in our interest. But it starts, the rational self-interest starts with the idea of self-interest and then says pursue it rationally. And rationally, when you work that out, means a whole bunch of things about virtue, and I would say including benevolence. Whereas enlightened self-interest kind of switches the polarity here and starts with the idea of serving others. Tocqueville was describing, private voluntary community help and other civic associations, but not state. So, but still serving others. But then explaining it. Yeah, this is really in my self-interest. So that's one of the reasons I've been reluctant to use that term. But I'll just throw that out as a consideration, Rob. I imagine it's on your, that issue, that point is already on your agenda somewhere.
Thanks, David. Rob, do you want to take that on, or can we get to some of the others here?
I'd like to defer. I was trying to talk, and I realized I was muted. I'd like to maybe defer it, and we'll, I definitely have more to say on that. And I think what David's on the right, on the same track as I am. But I'd like to hear from a couple other people on this, too. I think that what I will say to David is I like the fact that the concept of enlightened self-interest is out there. It has centuries of history behind it. So I think it's really good to say to take advantage of that, to say, look, this is a whole moral philosophy that existed for centuries that people took very seriously, and then use that to bring up the conversation. Well, let's, what is it? What would it mean for self-interest to be enlightened? What is it that enlightens it? And I think that's where the term enlightened self-interest, it's vague. It doesn't explain by what principle is your self-interest enlightened. And that's where we need to, but it's an opportunity for us to make that case. But I'd like to hear from other people.
Roger.
Hey, Jennifer. Hey. Yeah, so my question is, it feels like we're splitting hairs here, and that whether we're using the term rational self-interest or enlightened self-interest, at the end of the day, we're still talking about egoism, and the idea that that our self-interest is what's critically important, and that we're not compelled to help others unless that does serve our self-interest. The old saying is that egoism is altruism. And so I just wonder, like, if we're getting too fancy with the words, and if maybe that egoism, which has interesting connotations to some people, where they almost have a gag reflex when they hear the word, because they think ego and they think egotism, and so it puts people off, which I don't mind that as a starting point, because I think that spawns an interesting conversation, which gets us to the same point, which is talking about our own self-interest and how everything we do, if not in our rational self-interest, is really irrational and immoral. And I'm just kind of curious why the need for the fluffiness of words here.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I think you can get too hair splitting, because the enlightened self-interest, like I said, it's a little vague, but it's not wrong. And if you actually look at, like, Jonathan Mayhew, look at his seven sermons, the famous sermons he gave, there's a lot of stuff in there that I think we would totally agree with. So I think the problem is not so much the terminology, but here's the reason why the terminology does become important is I do think, especially, in that Tocqueville quote there, that they meant a little something different from by enlightened self-interest than we meant. And also I want to point out, you said egoism is altruism is one of the formulas there. that basically by doing, you know, good things for yourself, you will also end up benefiting other people. But here's the problem. For, and this is especially looking at it from the philosophical perspective, you know, for the philosopher, you do have to split the hairs. You do have to go to the exact words. And the reason for that is that altruism is sometimes used now in this sort of loose way of saying, meaning, well, anything that helps another person. So, you know, if you smile at somebody and wave and you know, you make them feel a little bit better, that's altruistic. Or if you help an old lady across the street, that's altruistic. You know, it's anything, anything that could possibly be benefit another person is altruism. But the thing is, for the first 100 years, and that's when that term existed, it was like, you know, that's not a term that just sort of, it was in the language from time immemorial. That term was created in a specific context for a specific purpose. And it was to promote an ideology that says you cannot pursue your self-interest at all. And I really recommend this is an, it's a little loose and it doesn't go as deeply as I would like, but it was a, if you Google altruism arrives in America, you'll find this article from Lewis Budd, a Duke University professor. It's from 1956, but he goes through his history and it gives you a little taste of it because there's a whole, there were these altruist societies that existed and there were, these people who wrote whole books and whole, you know, long fictional treatises about sort of ideal communities, ideal altruist communities who were based on this idea that nobody would ever do anything on their self-interest. It reminds me of, I've done a little research into the, I don't know if you've done some of this or know much about, you may have done some of this, David, as well. I did some research into the origin of the term individualism. And I found out that the individualism began as a pejorative. It was actually the roots of it in America, at least. I think there's an earlier use in France, but in French. But in America, the roots of it are from one of these communes that was formed called in New Harmony, Indiana. And it was this this commune is supposed to be done on these sort of socialist principles. And they identified in their newsletter for their commune, they identified that the enemy, the thing that they were against was individualism. And that was the problem of everything, is too much concern for the well-being and personal judgment of the individual. And the fascinating part about the history is that this commune went through the usual history of these things, the life cycle of these things. It burned out in about 3 years and it ended in bitterness and recriminations. And most of the people went on and continued to advocate exactly the same ideas with no change, not having learned a single thing. But one guy coming out of that, and I can never remember his name, he's not a well-known person, but one guy came out of that, actually drew the conclusion from it that, wait a minute, our mistake was we were against individualism. And he went on, now he had some crackpot economic notions, but he went on to promote the idea that individualism was a good thing and was part of sort of turning individualism into this sort of laudable, you know, the way we use it today, good old American individualism. He was part of that. And it came from coming out of this commune where they thought that individualism was the worst thing. And he realized what a mistake that was. So that's why I think sometimes splitting the hairs is useful in that regard.
And it's worth noting here that, as you say, individualism was coined by the term, was coined by the enemies of individualism, as was the term capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So we're laboring under, as advocates of both of those principles, we're laboring under the, you know, the kind of conceptual reversal. But we are doing the conceptual reversal by saying these are great things, good things. But we still have that burden of the negative connotations imposed on them by their enemies.
Thank you, David. Great question, Roger. Melanie, what does the topic mean to you? You got to unmute yourself. If you can. And as you're trying to do that, Scott. Scott, you want to?
Hi there. Thank you. Good topic. I'm interested in the idea if
You know, because I'm fascinated by the history and what you were talking about with Comte. And, you know, if there's just something where in our history that as, you know, we started to have a certain level of material wealth that the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution were providing, that it was just natural for people to start thinking, gee, I want to help others. And then, you know, as these preachers were even becoming more rational in their own way, if it led to just like a power vacuum, and that's why altruism became just like the new basis in a way for socialism.
You know, I think this actually goes back even deeper, which is, you know, we all come out of what is, I mean, the sort of, I won't say natural, but the primitive organization for most human societies is tribalism, right? You are part of a tribe, you're part of a family, and you all sort of gather together, you rally together as a collective, and you know, it's tribalism in the good sense of you have this community support, these people who are near and dear to you, who are supporting you, whom you're cooperating with, who are working together. But it's also tribalism in the bad sense, which is, you know, my tribe versus your tribe, people splitting into groups and having their identity be formed by their loyalty to the group. And I think that's all deep into the whole history of mankind. And a lot of our earliest moral theories come out of that tribal background and have that tribal element to it, that, you know, you can't just be pursuing your own interests. You have to sacrifice for the greater good of the whole, for the state, for, you know, what have you. So, you know, the earliest moral philosophers, you get guys, you know, you get Plato, who comes up with an ideal society, an ideal republic, in which everyone is sort of regimented for the good of the state on sort of quasi Spartan model of society, where you know, self interest is viewed as something that has to be subordinated to the greater good of the state. So it's an issue that people have been struggling with and going back and forth on. Over, you know, since the beginning of the time that, since the beginning of philosophy, since the beginning of the time that we became self-aware about these issues, we've had these two things. On the one hand, we know our survival depends on independent individuals, sometimes who are able to go out and, you know, who are able to go out and do things that other people can't do, who are able to come up with new ideas, and the fact that people have to want to be able, have to be rewarded for doing unusual things and for accomplishing unusual things, and that benefits everyone. So there's the that element of individualism is there. And if you look back at the ancient Greeks, even the worst of the ancient Greeks, even somebody like Plato, there was still an implicit egoism in there somewhere, buried in there, because there was still a sense that you as an individual would want to be happy, and that's okay. It really takes Christianity to take that idea of you shouldn't even want to be happy and to begin imposing that. And that's really the achievement of the early centuries of achievement, if you want to call it that, of the early centuries of Christianity, as they create this monastic ideal of these guys going out in the desert and starving themselves and, you know, taking vows of silence and all of this stuff of that the measure of your virtue is how much you attack yourself and make yourself miserable. That's really the addition of Christianity that brought it in there. And that's the otherworldliness of Christianity, the idea that you should not be oriented at all to anything in this world. You should be oriented entirely to another world. But this is something that goes all the way back, that you have elements of individualism and elements of tribalism, elements of sort of supernaturalism. And I think that's where this Tocqueville quote comes in, is that Tocqueville is a guy who's very much on the fence on this. He's on the edge, because the whole book he writes with a lot of admiration of the American approach, but he himself is, you know, basically a Catholic with sort of medievalist sympathies, feudalist sympathies, coming from this French context. So you can see what he's doing here is he treats enlightened, and I think to some extent this is how what the doctrine was at the time. He treats it as sort of a compromise, a middle ground, between as a way of sort of trying to synthesize an element of individualism with an element of self-sacrifice or of collectivism, you know, that you you will give part of your time and wealth for the good of the state. There's the sort of for the good of the state, it's sort of the collectivist formulation. But at the same time, you'll say, oh, but it's also somehow benefits me. And sometimes that somehow can be a little vague. So I think it was an attempt to sort of try to find a solution between these two opposing ideologies, these two opposing ideals, by finding a kind of a compromise. And I think what's different between that and at least the spirit of it that's different between that and the objectivist idea of rational self-interest is that we're not trying to do that compromise. We're trying to come up with a way to integrate, to come at it from a perspective where we can say, no, you can act in a way that's fully in your self-interest, but because it's your rational self-interest, it's your long-term self-interest, therefore, that doesn't mean, you know, being a nihilist and, you know, burning everything down. It means that you also take consideration for, you know, you want to live in a free society, you want to live in a society where there's law and order, etc. So you will voluntarily restrain yourself from doing certain things. You will volunteer to help in certain ways to make that society function, but you do it, you know, but the question of what's the most important thing has been settled. You're doing it because in the long term, this is in your self-interest. So it's a way to sort of the objectivist conceptualization is more like we're not trying to make a compromise between two opposing ideas. We're trying to show how you can have a benevolent society based just on the one idea of doing what is in your self-interest, but what is rationally in your self-interest.
All right, Melanie, I think you know how to unmute now.
Hello, everyone. Yeah, I did it. So this is such an interesting discussion, as so many of these discussions are. But I did want to speak up because I am probably the only social worker in the audience. And I would like to point out that in social work, we are trained to practice self-care and to practice, boundaries and not crossing the line where we become depleted in our work, and that one is expected to get a lot of self-esteem and wonderful things from being a social worker. And I would like to point out there are other professions like this, like doctors and nurses and people in the military and EMT workers who also have that same philosophy. They do a certain amount of service, but this is their profession. They feel good about it. So sometimes I feel like social workers get a bad rap and are seen as either self-sacrificing or looking for power, trying to dominate other things. So I'm just clearing up social work's reputation here. Thank you.
You know, when it comes to social work, I also point out, and I'm sure that you might want to expand on this, that when it comes to the help that you're giving to those other people, one of the things that you have to be doing is helping them get, if you actually want to help somebody, you have to help them get to the point where they are able to act in their rational self-interest. That is, you don't want somebody to become permanently dependent or permanently a ward of the state if they're at all capable of being able to support themselves or to take control of their own lives and their own situation. That you're not looking for them to become selfless in that sense.
Well, thank you for pointing that out. That is absolutely true. And helping people realize their goals, you're not having them realize your goals and to be more independent and more productive, or to be able to manage independently, is definitely the goal. Of course, there are lots of different circumstances, but that's very true. Thank you for bringing that up.
The one thing I find interesting in the last 10 or 15 years is there's been, you know, something that has been part of the objectivist arguments and part of Ayn Rand's literature for a long time, is this idea of these sort of pathological altruist relationships where you quote unquote help somebody else out, but what you really want is for them to be dependent on you. She wrote a whole play, it's called Think Twice. She wrote a murder mystery. And that I'm trying not to give too much away because it's worth reading or seeing it performed if it's ever performed. But the premise of it is that a guy's murdered, and the guy who's murdered has this reputation of being a great philanthropist. And so initially the guy who's investigating it says, well, this is going to be, you know, it's going to be hard to tell who could possibly have a motive to kill this guy. And what he finds out when he gets in there is everybody has a motive to kill him because he gives his charity in this pathological way where he gives it in a way to sort of control other people and make them dependent on him and divert them from what they really want to do. And so it turns out everybody around the guy resents him because he's been pathological in the way that he attempts to help people in a way that hurts them. And I've seen the fascinating thing. She wrote that play in, I think, the 1940s. And the thing I think is interesting about that is in recent decades, I've started to hear the use of the term pathological altruism. Somebody wrote a book on that subject, and also toxic charity. So these are concepts that people are coming up that are trying to explain that phenomenon of, and I think usually the explanation is that the person who's giving the charity or the person who's being pathologically altruistic is more concerned with how they feel and with their position of power over and control over the other person. And they don't really care about whether it actually is in the interest of that, what they're doing is actually helping the other person or not. So they're more focused on, I get the sense of power, I get a boost of self-esteem, or it makes me feel, you know, they're more concerned about how they feel or the sense of superiority that it gives them. Now, I think that they can go, a lot could be added to that, and you go farther in the analysis by bringing in Ayn Rand's analysis of this, which is that, you know, rational self-interest is the natural and to be an expected state for all people, and that altruism, to the extent that it's taken as this idea of making people dependent and making people not pursuing their own self-interest, that the object of your help is also not supposed to pursue his self-interest, that's when it becomes pathological. I think she can offer a deeper level of analysis to that.
Thanks, Rob, and thank you, Melanie. Richard.
Thank you, Rob. This is fascinating. And your earlier exchange with David on Enlightened, I mean, at least enlightenment means reason, and it comes from the Enlightenment. So I don't have as much a problem with, you know, calling it enlightened self-interest and reaching back to that lineage, especially in today when there's a counter-enlightenment or postmodernism. But I did notice when I read my de Tocqueville on self-interest, he at one point actually said it counters individualism, and self-interest is something like small acts of sacrifice, not big ones. So it's a very mixed message, but for that time, it was amazing. I just wanted to point out something that might be interesting to the discussion. And Rob, there is in Peikoff, in Opar, three cases where he says, this is why we need to modify these words. And this gets back to what Roger said about, is this hair splitting? So in three cases, he says, he's talking about self-interest, and he says rational self-interest. And then he discusses it and he says, unfortunately, it's a redundancy, but necessary today. Then later he says, laissez-faire capitalism. He uses the same words. He says, it's a redundancy, but a necessary one in today's linguistic chaos. Then later, earlier actually, individual rights. He says, that's a redundancy, although necessary in today's intellectual chaos. I've always found that very interesting. But what he's basically saying is, rational self-interest is the only kind of self-interest. There's no such thing as irrational self-interest. And he'd say there's no such thing as anything other than laissez-faire capitalism. You know, what do we hear today? There's crony capitalism and state capitalism and welfare capitalism. And same thing with individual rights, right? He said, no, they only belong to individuals, neither to groups nor to pieces of individuals like a fetus. So I just wanted to bring that in there because I think that helps the issue of why are we bothering with the modifier? Are we just hair splitting? Or in Peikoff's case, he would say, oh, no, this is absolutely necessary in today's conceptual chaos. That's it.
Yeah. You know, I think it's interesting that, you know, part of the purpose, though, of the concept of rational, putting the rational in self-interest, you know, philosophers spend a lot of our time doing necessary redundancies, you know, where it's like we have to put an extra word in there because there are so many common misinterpretations of the concept, you know, because you've gone thousands of years coming out of the primitive tribal societies that we came out of. There are countless concepts that human beings developed so early on in our development that they didn't quite get it right. You know, they knew they needed this concept, but they couldn't quite conceptualize it properly. And then all sorts of wrong conceptualizations of it or misconceptualizations of it built up over centuries and centuries. So when you get the right version of the idea, you then have to put all these extra terms on to explain it because you have to differentiate it from all the sort of missed attempts at getting the concept. And I think that definitely applies to self-interest. And one of the reasons you put it on there is the fact that there are people who have the concept of self-interest as being short-range self-interest, you know, that the self-interest of the criminal, the self-interest of the con man, the self-interest of the persons that are grabbing whatever they, you know, the manipulator who grabs whatever he can on the short term. And, you know, like I said, you know, in that argument earlier about people, you know, being told you not getting a vaccine is selfish. There are a lot of people who have taken that seriously and said, well, if that's selfishness, I'm going to be selfish, right? So Ayn Rand made this point, actually, that if you say self-interest is evil, people will conclude that evil is in their self-interest. It's not quite, she doesn't quite use that terminology, but it's words close to that. That if you tell people selfishness is evil, they will conclude that evil is in their self-interest. So they take things that actually are bad to do, and they will say, oh, that must be what selfishness is, so I'm going to be selfish. So that's part of the rescuing campaign she's doing with rational self-interest, is saying, all right, to something to actually be in your self-interest, you have to think through, that's the rational part, you have to think through all the consequences. You have to think through those consequences over the long term and over the big picture. And then you will see that, you know, robbing a bank is not in your self-interest. And if anybody wants to, if anybody wants to contest that, we'll have a long discussion about bank robbery. I'd love to have that. But the point being that that's part of the reason you need the concept of rational self-interest is to differentiate it from various forms of irrational self-interest that people have accepted and pursued over time. And I think that's what one of the reasons I like rational self-interest better than enlightened self-interest or self-interest properly understood is it is more specific about by what means are you enlightening your concept of self-interest? By what means are you properly understanding it? So it says by means of reason, which implies, you know, that you're thinking through the consequences of your actions, that you're looking at the long term, you're looking at the big picture. So I think it carries a more precise idea, whereas I think enlightened self-interest or self-interest properly understood can be more of a vague idea to mean, well, it's a compromise between self-interest enlightened by various forms of by an element of altruism, by a compromise with altruism in the Comtean sense. And so that's why I think that those terms are more likely to be misunderstood, whereas rational self-interest has the benefit of being more precise.
Thank you. All right. We're going to pull rank a little bit here with the chairman of the board of the Atlas Society, without whom none of us would be here. Jay LaPere has actually a similar background to Melanie, having been steeped in the altruist roots of Catholic Louisiana. Jay.
Yeah. Still getting over some of that. Rob, the context for communicating and tagging on to what Richard said about terms being redundant but necessary, in our mission, we we mention reason, but then we also mention ethical and benevolent self-interest. The purpose there was to clarify exactly the points that you've just framed, that reason alone doesn't seem to get some people past the idea that it's still in your interest to, you know, violate ethics and not grant the same, you know, respect for rights to others. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's all sorts of ways in which, depending on the context you're talking in, that like I said, these useful redundancies are grist for the mill, because so many terms have been misunderstood. And Ayn Rand talked about the epistemological chaos that we have. But I think that chaos is just is partly, you know, our particular era. There have been a number of prominent and influential philosophers who have muddled a lot of these ideas. But I also think it's just part of human history, right? That you have, it's sort of like, you know, there's all sorts of ideas you encounter as a kid, right? You the ideas you encounter, words and concepts you encounter when you're 8 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old, long before you're old enough to independently think them through and make them very exact. But it's a necessary concept. So you acquire some version of that concept based on, you know, where you come, people around you, what they say, gleaning the best version of that as you can from the context in which you grow up. And then later on, you have to go back and re-examine it and say, well, what does selfish really mean? You know, is it really a bad thing? You know, maybe you were told your entire life being self-interest is bad. You might have to go back and reevaluate that. But I think that, you know, what the individual has to do is basically what humanity as a whole has had to do. That there's all sorts of concepts that we had to develop and get our first grasp of, you know, 3,000 years ago or 4,000 years ago, when we were, you know, the state of human knowledge was so primitive that we couldn't possibly have thought through it in a really exact and precise way. And it would have been very strange if we'd gotten it right the first time. So it's sort of natural that you're going to have every really big, important concept in human life is going to have this 3,000 year history to it, of various different versions of the idea, and many of them which are wrong, that you're then going to have to come up with various explanatory things to differentiate yourself from that history.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of capturing the essential point, because I don't think our understanding of what self-interest or selfishness is has changed or deviated. What is difficult is how to explain that in a condensed version. So depending on the context of your audience or what your purpose is, it seems to me that enlightened self-interest, rational self-interest, you know, ethical or benevolent self-interest, all those things are part of that redundancy that's needed depending on what you expect to be the most important aspects of what you're trying to communicate. Is that a fair way to think about it?
Yeah, I think so. And I liked Richard's point earlier about how one of the reasons I've become more likely to use the phrase enlightened self-interest is there's been this burst of activity in the last 3 or 4 years of greater interest in the Enlightenment and people embracing the legacy of the Enlightenment, you know, the 18th century philosophy as an answer to both the you know, the woke left and the sort of a liberal or nationalist right. And the nationalist right is very much against the Enlightenment. The religious right guys are very much against the Enlightenment. They hate the Enlightenment. So the idea of you got people like Stephen Pinker and on the right, you have Jonah Goldberg, who are more or less advocating Enlightenment ideas. So coming and saying enlightened self-interest, which is this phrase straight out of the Enlightenment, out of the 18th century, I think it's a way to sort of provide this little entree to people like that to say, you know, you really should reconsider this issue of altruism and self-interest, because that's tied into this Enlightenment legacy I think people are beginning to, some people at least, are beginning to understand that this Enlightenment legacy is really important and we need to understand it better and sort of revive it. So connecting into that, I think, you know, enlightened self-interest gives you that opportunity to start that conversation of connecting to that trend.
Jennifer, if I can make a quick point before we move on.
Yeah, go ahead. another 10 minutes, and I do want to get to JP and Vessi.
Yes. Okay, great. A quick point. In philosophy, in courses on ethics, that virtually every textbook you open will start out with a discussion of egoism, which it treats as non-rational, just pursuing subjective self-interest. And the whole point is, and I've talked to many people in the field who teach this stuff, the obvious point is, let's get past this stupid theory and get into the real ones. And that is still so common. So in terms of the, you know, the modifier rational, and even rational versus enlightenment, look, I'm a philosopher. I split hairs for a living. I'm kind of a professional. Philosophical barber, you know, issue comes to me, I don't want to frizz up its hair. But but also, one of the problems with the concepts of enlightened self-interest is in the era in which the term was coined and used, was people had, despite the, you know, the grandeur of the concepts of individual rights and individualism and free markets that all came online more or less simultaneously, you know, in the century before, half centuries before and after 1800, they had not escaped the altruist baggage that came with religion and with the Christian traditions, even among atheists. And so, you know, I'll reference one, David Mayer, late David Mayer, professor of law, gave a great lecture once for us. I called The Unfinished Work of the American Revolution, and it was about the lack of a clear egoist basis for it. So that said, I'll yield the floor again.
Thank you, JP. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Jennifer. So my question is probably one of those chicken and egg. What was first, collectivism or altruism? And the second part is, when did we go wrong, really, with this code of ethics that the West holds? I used to attribute it to the Marxist-Leninist movement, and then I stumbled into the works of a very wise Spaniard by the name of Antonio Escotado on the Enemies of Commerce, Volume 1, when he traces the ethics of altruism all the way back to Jesus and Christianity and the episode when he throws all the merchants out of the marketplace. That's probably when the West got the Judeo-Christian tradition began vilifying gain, interest, profit, wealth. And so if that's the case, isn't it a very tall order to bring it all down?
Yes, absolutely. I agree. It is a very tall order. Well, I think the thing is, these are issues, like I said, go back to the very beginning of human self-awareness. So if you ask which came first, altruism or collectivism, I would say what came first was tribalism. Tribalism came from the fact that we were all out there living in tribes as hunter-gatherers, you know, 10,000 years ago, before the first cities were built, we were all out there living in tribes. And the tribal ethos was part of human social organization from the very, very beginning. And then disentangling that from and the battle between, well, we need individuals to be self-reliant, we need individuals to be creative, we need individuals to come up with new ideas, we need individuals to be able to, you know, to enjoy their own, to be able to pursue their own interests, or else, you know, nothing will get done. All of that those are issues we've been worrying about and going back and forth on for a very long period of time. And one of the things I find interesting about the concept of enlightened self-interest and its popularity in the 18th century and its long roots going back, you know, you can see roots of it in Aristotle and other thinkers, other ancient thinkers, is that it's astonishing to me that view ever came to be as prominent as it was. So, you know, you say we have 10,000 years of history to overcome in terms of fighting that sort of tribalist version. But by the same token, we also have, the good news is we also have a couple thousand years of history of people making better arguments and trending towards the idea of rational self-interest, even if sometimes it's compromised or vague or it's not quite there. I think the important thing about the concept of enlightened self-interest is to see that in terms of disentangling this issue and making it more precise and more exact, a lot of progress has already been made through thousands of years of history. And then we could sort of reclaim that and use that and connect to that and hopefully take it the very last next step to clarify those concepts even further.
Thank you. And Bessie, we're saving the best for last, no pressure.
Oh, hello, everyone, Rob and everyone. Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment, to be honest, about what Rob's comments a few while back amongst the people about the toxic collectivism and all that stuff. I totally agree. I think very often, toxic altruism that you mentioned. I think sometimes those are the thickest masks in our society. giving philanthropy, collectivism, the good charity person. Again, not all. I mean, some are well-intentioned. But very often it hides something and a dependency. Actually, there's someone called Dr. Romani, who's a big hit on YouTube right now, and she talks about the collective narcissist, which is very interesting because, you know, you have your boisterous narcissist, like a Trump-like figure, but they're kind of easy to spot and you know what's coming, whereas the collective narcissist is actually in a way more kind of dangerous because they seem all good on the outside. And it just reminds me a lot of Tui. I thought that might be interesting for you guys to check out at some point.
Yeah, I definitely will. It sounds interesting. You know, I think Tui is a great character because one thing I noticed talking about it recently is that there are other characters somewhat similar to him in other literature at that time. So those who've read 1984 might remember the character of O'Brien, who's sort of the Ellsworth Tui of that story. And so I think it's interesting that there was this sort of educated and pseudo-idealistic collectivist who's actually evil down to the core, who's actually motivated by lust for power. And that was a sort of a type that people were beginning to notice, especially in the early 20th century, when you had these, you know, fascist and communist ideologies that arose, where you had this, you know, the great man speaking for the people, and we have all these sacrifices that have to be done for the people, but then you notice it's really about the power, the lust for power, and the malignant narcissism of that particular person. So that sort of hidden, and specifically that sort of intellectualized, hidden, I'm just here as a humble servant of the people kind of narcissist. I think it was a type of character that people needed to try to figure out. And Tui is, of course, Ayn Rand's great contribution to that.
Yeah, and even on a more modern term, I mean, not as extreme as that, but, you know, I mean, in Hollywood, there's plenty. I mean, Harvey Weinstein gave $10 million to the Clintons. He went on the Women's March. The Women's March. As a good women's rights, and the irony of what he really was, that's the thing. I think with a toxic altruism, as you call it, the mask can be thicker, and so it's nearly more evil in a way, I think.
Yeah, and I really recommend, if you can find it, there's a book called The Early Ayn Rand that has her play Think Twice, which has a variation on that theme.
All right, thank you. Thomas, I do see your hand up, but we are past hour. And unless I thought I saw Professor Stephen Hicks's hand up, but if not, then we are going to end it. You guys are playing to my altruist weaknesses when you send me the last minute requests to speak, because I feel bad. But I want to thank Rob for this great topic, and thank our founder, David Kelly, for joining. Thank our senior scholar, Richard Salzman, also for joining in, and everybody for all your great questions and engagement. Fessy, especially, I thought that was fascinating. We're going to check it out. Could merit its own whole clubhouse discussion. So I want to also let you guys know we are going to be back here on Thursday with our founder, David Kelly. He is going to be talking about fact versus opinion. Also, if you're interested, tomorrow I'm going to have a live webinar with Amjad Massad. He is the founder of Replit, which is a coding community platform. But that is not so much what brought him to our attention. He had a thread as a immigrant who came to America with nothing but credit card debt, and then recently became a citizen. He had a thread on Twitter, 10 Things I Love About This Country, which went viral and sparked a whole lot of interesting feedback. So I'm going to be talking to him about that tomorrow. And then, yes, also Professor Salzman is going to be having a morals and markets conversation, believe on cryptocurrency, the economics and politics of cryptocurrency. That's coming up on Thursday. So if you check out the Atlas Society's events page, you'll see all of the great things we got planned for you. And look forward to seeing you then.